This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Oh, hello to you, Birmingham, England, and hello to you, Laos. Oh, and my friends in Barcelona, God bless you. I'm sure glad that you're still trying to explain things to the government of Spain. We have some explanations to take care of on the God Show this week. Explanations of how it is that a tiny bit of chemical substance can kill an enormous number of people, and how that chemical substance was legally prescribed for people like my guest, Timothy King. Oh, and by the way, I should say that his name on the book is Timothy McMahon King. But I also want to add, there's no preference given when we choose somebody with the name of the host, although I probably will be easily persuaded into keeping you around for 2 or 3 hours just to explain to everybody about your book, The Addiction Nation, What the Opioid Crisis Reveals About Us. But Tim, this is the God Show, and we deal in an unlimited number of subjects, all of them dealing with the spiritual nature of mankind. We're responsible for good lives. And you say in your book that religion has failed when it comes to drug abuse. Explain.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. And it does feel to be in good company with another McMahon. And I certainly don't think I'll get preferential treatment, but I am sure that this will be a good discussion, because I think one of the things that I really believe is when you see something that is happening like our current overdose crisis, one of the first things I say in the book is that you need to understand that the opioid crisis isn't just about opioids. We had over 70,000 people die from overdoses last year in the United States. That is more people people died last year from overdoses than Americans who died in the Vietnam and Korean Wars combined.
Amazing.
And this didn't just start last year, and this isn't just about opioids. Every year since 1979, we've seen every 9 years overdoses in the United States double. And that was also the year that President Jimmy Carter gave a speech that later became known as the Malaise Speech. But it was also a moment that he warned that he saw the country becoming increasingly fragmented, people becoming increasingly individualistic and materialistic. And I now think we can look back on that speech and see him as having some prophetic words for the country. And those weren't primarily political words, but they were words about where our nation's soul is. And one of the things that we can see with addiction is outside of these other drug overdoses, we also have alcohol-related deaths. When you add up driving accidents, homicides, alcohol-related deaths from like cirrhosis of the liver, that's another 88,000 people dying every year. We have a deeper crisis of addiction in this country. And I think that addiction takes root when people feel unmoored and when they are searching for something deeper and they're searching for something greater. And the best they can find is that substance or that behavior they become addicted to. And that's what takes control of their lives.
But if they were searching, Tim, for a spiritual answer, they may have gone to a church. They may have counseled with a minister or a priest or a rabbi. But you said in the book that religion has failed when it came to drug abuse. And I repeat my question, how is that?
I think it's failed in a few different ways. One is that it's failed to understand what addiction really is and how it can be a part of the solution. And normally, I think in a lot of religious communities, addiction is characterized as this relentless pursuit of some sort of physical pleasure. When in reality, I think that addiction is often the pursuit of some sort of greater moral purpose and meaning. And that is where the substance or the behavior comes into play. And so when we, in a religious or spiritual context, dismiss people, when we blame people, when we make them feel ashamed for what is happening in their life, or create a new context in which those who struggle with addictions have become kind of the lepers of our society today, we actually help people on that downward spiral, because it is that kind of shame and silence that actually makes addictions worse. So when we have spiritual communities or religious communities where people can't be open, where they don't feel like they can be vulnerable, where they don't feel like they can admit to the struggles that they're having, I think that's a failure of what religion is supposed to be best at. And that's where one of the passages that I dealt with in my book and I struggled with personally was in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus tells his followers to be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Well, that seems to be pretty clear and straightforward. Perfection is a high standard, and that's what Jesus was calling his followers to. But when you dive into it and you're looking at the commentaries and you're looking at the original language, it's not so much of this idea of a moral blamelessness as it is a wholeness and a pursuit, in that case, of loving your neighbor as yourself. And so I think when we create communities where there's these ideals and expectations where we all need to have our lives together and we need to put on airs about our normal cultural representations of success, then we lose those opportunities to be real and support each other in the midst of our struggles. And I think that is religion at its best, and I think that's something that we've failed to do.
You think that religion has failed when it comes to drug abuse in general because religion, organized religion, for the most part, doesn't understand drug abuse?
Yeah. One thing that when we think about drug abuse, the common phrase that I heard in the recovery community is most people don't have drug problems, they have drug solutions. They are using a substance to solve for something in their lives. And when we demonize a substance, so one of the other areas that I dive into is this idea that when you make a substance evil in and of itself, as opposed to recognizing that what we call evil or what we call sin is actually a disordering of something good. So I went into the hospital. I was in acute respiratory distress. My organs were shutting down, and I was in the ICU. I had had a procedure go wrong. When I was first given morphine and then Dilaudid and then fentanyl patches on top of that, those substances were actually a great need for me. They were helping me to stay alive. My doctors told me later that if they hadn't treated that pain, they were worried that it would keep spiraling down and that my organs would start to shut down even more, that I wouldn't make it. So what started off as a medicine, what started off as a benefit, it was later that my relationship to it changed. And what I did not realize at the time, but I discovered later as I was reflecting on this experience, is that those opioids that I was on weren't just answering a physical pain, but also a distress that I felt about not knowing about whether or not I would live throughout the week. And so one of the reasons why opioids are so powerful, one of the reasons why any drugs are so powerful, is not because they are so foreign to our brains, but because they mimic the chemicals that our brains are already producing and the processes that our brains are already engaged in. And with opioids in particular, they closely resemble endorphins, and they resemble them so much the word endorphin itself is actually the combination of the two words endogenous, meaning occurring within, and morphine. So when those chemicals were first discovered, they've discovered that endorphins bond us to each other. They make us feel loved. They make us feel connected. They make us feel like we have purpose. And that's exactly what opioids are doing as well. They give a temporary sense of that feeling of love and connection and purpose. And so when we come at somebody with an addiction, with that stance of shame or blame, all that makes them want to do is retreat to that substance even more because it's treating that thing in their life. But when we acknowledge the pain that's underneath an addiction and we are partners with people in that, I think that's when we have the best opportunity to help someone overcome.
I want to go into far more deeply into your story because the drama of that experience, as I read about it in Addiction Nation, a book, by the way, just out a matter of a couple of weeks, it is so compelling that if one would read it first before ever being involved in any way with any pain-killing medication, you might possibly give second and third thoughts because of the experience of my guest, Timothy McMahon King. But before we do this, let's talk about people outside of Tim King. 115 people died yesterday from opioid misuse. Who were they?
So one thing is, even since the book has come out, that statistic has changed. It is now 130 per day. And we know a few things about people who are struggling with opioid addiction and especially dying from overdoses. The primary demographic right there is actually now white men between the ages of 25 and 45.
Mm.
That's the most common person. And I, for your readers to know, I'm a white guy and just turned 35 a couple days ago. So I'm spot in the middle of that demographic. There's a few other things that we know is that most people now, about three quarters of people who end up trying some sort of heavier illicit opioid started at some point on prescription opioids. Now, that may not have been from their doctor, but it could have been from a friend or a family member that they got those drugs. They are also highly likely to be in areas of lower social capital and higher dislocation. So one of the things that has shifted in my own understanding about addiction is I always thought of primarily blaming the chemical, right? So whenever you have an epidemic, you can look at it, what's new that's been added into the environment, or what has changed inside the host. So we can see very clearly a lot of new prescription opioids were dumped in 1996. The FDA approved OxyContin as what they call the minimally addictive opioid analgesic. It turns out the pharmaceutical company that was behind that knowingly deceived regulators, knowingly deceived doctors. They spread misinformation. And there's a lot of blame to go towards those pharmaceutical companies. But at the same time, we also need to ask, has anything changed in our society that has made people more susceptible to that kind of addiction? And one of the studies that I think could help your listeners think differently about who these people might be was done by a researcher named Bruce Alexander. And he watched all these different experiments that were done where rats in cages would be given different addictive substances, sometimes opioids, sometimes cocaine. And they would watch these rats just keep pressing this button for more and more of this substance until the rats would kill themselves. And so a lot of the researchers said, all right, we found it. It's these substances themselves that get such a deep chemical hook in people's brains that they just can't get off of them. Well, Bruce Alexander asked, what if it isn't just about the substance, but it's actually about the cage that the rat was in? And so he designed a series of experiments that he ended up calling Rat Park. And so instead of it being a small cage where the rat was alone, it was a large environment that mimicked a rat's natural environment and had lots of pieces of paper for them to play with, lots of wood shavings, lots of friends, lots of mates. And it was a whole big community of rats. Well, at the end of the experiment, they kept seeing they could never induce the same kind of addiction they saw when those rats had a positive environment that occurs than when they were in a cage. So I tell this story because I think we need to ask today, is it possible that our country, the suburbs, the rural areas, whether this is urban areas, is it possible that we are all in environments that are a lot more like those small rat cages, alone and isolated and disconnected, than we would like to admit? And that might be some of this, some of what's underlying this new epidemic. And that's why you can see it happening in rural areas where people are out of work. Maybe they were in a mine, maybe they were in a factory and they slipped a disc and they have pain in their back that's constant and they can't stop thinking about it and they can't work anymore. So they're looking for something to not only pass their time, but to give them a sense of meaning and purpose. Or maybe it's a 17-year-old out in the suburbs who is feeling disconnected from their friends and their family, and they have all the physical things that they have. They have a big, beautiful house in the suburbs, but it turns out that that kind of American dream is not as fulfilling as we once thought. And so there is a whole wide spectrum of people that are affected by this. And breaking out of that stereotype of just thinking about somebody who has lived a hard life or has been partying or things like that, we need to understand that addiction is something that's possible for each and every one of us with the wrong situation and the wrong circumstance.
Thought-provoking answer about those now 130 people who died yesterday from opioid misuse. You've talked to us demographically about who they were, but it was really surprising to me to find out where they lived, because you talk about the two states in your book that have more opioid addicts on a per capita basis anyway, than the rest of the states. Tell everybody what the two states are.
Yeah, and I'll add a third to the list. So it's often West Virginia, Ohio, and then my home state of New Hampshire as the states with the highest per capita overdose rates in the country.
Wow, wow. West Virginia, if you stop 1,000 Americans on the street and say, describe West Virginia, most of them will probably do it in terms of coal mining and that kind of industry. With Ohio, a huge variety of humanity, and New Hampshire, peaceful area of New England, naturally beautiful, the kind of place that the Christmas card folks go to create pictures for their cards. Why New Hampshire?
So this has been a discussion that has made a lot of researchers wonder, because one thing that the areas of Ohio and West Virginia that have been most affected, as well as certain areas of Kentucky or western parts of Virginia, we're all fairly demographically similar, that there was a lot of burned out mining towns and factory towns where you had a huge and sudden drop in employment opportunities, where people were searching for meaning and they were poor. And what they often had, the only thing they had access to was some sort of medicine, often the opioids, that did something for the pain they really had from some sort of workplace accident. And that was kind of that early fire that was lit. And so some people have wondered about New Hampshire, because it is, everything you said about New Hampshire is absolutely true. But one of the confounding things is New Hampshire also has one of the highest median incomes in the country. Mm-hmm. So it's not the wealthiest state by any stretch of the imagination, but a lot of very solidly middle class folks. And so there's a few possible explanations there. One is New Hampshire does still have pockets of poverty that, because of that other high median income, has been overlooked. Another possibility that people have discussed is easy different routes from different drug trafficking hubs. So fentanyl is something that most people didn't know about five years ago, and it now is in the news all the time. There's easy access to fentanyl labs coming in from around the area. It's not coming in from other countries. It's being made locally, and that's something that contributes to it. But one of the most interesting theories is something that was hard for me to admit, but I've had to grapple with it because I've always been kind of proud of this, and that is New Hampshire is the live free or die state.
Yes.
It's a state that values independence. It's a state that values saying, I don't need anybody else, and no one else can tell me what to do. We also still don't have a seatbelt law. That's one of the other curious things about New Hampshire and how deep that goes. But that has been something that New Hampshire has traditionally, and this has changed in the past year or so, traditionally some of the lowest expenditures per capita on treatment. But also, I think one of the biggest cultures of, I can do this on my own. And one of the things that I realized in my story, so I came back, I had been living in Washington, D.C. when I had my medical issues and when I was initially struggling with my own addiction. And years later, I moved back to my family's farm in New Hampshire, and I started hearing all of these stories about people overdosing on illicit fentanyl or sometimes the same patches of fentanyl that I had been on just a few years before. And when I looked around at those other stories, I had gone in just deep enough. I had felt that pull and that compulsion to keep using just strong enough that when I heard these stories of others, you know, some terrible stories of, you know, kids being locked in, you know, strapped into high chairs by their parents who then would use drugs and leave those kids there for hours or maybe even days. And I heard these terrible stories. And at the same time, I felt this sense of revulsion of how could anyone do that to a child? But I also felt deep down inside me this sense of being complicit, that I actually had known the power of an addiction over me into a way that never happened for me in my life. But I actually could see how it could happen in the life of another. And when I looked at what changed for me, it was not my own strength of will. It wasn't because I was smarter than other people. It was because I believe I had a community of grace around me who helped me through that process. And I truly believed that if other people were open to that kind of community of grace or were being offered that kind of community of grace, they could overcome too. And that's why I decided I needed to tell my story publicly, because my story was one of early detection. Everything went right. My doctor, when he sat me down and talked to me about my addiction, he didn't shame me. He didn't get upset with me. And I had had that happen before. I had had three separate times doctors had said, we think you're abusing your pain medicine. And each time they had actually missed a medical complication that was causing my ongoing pain. But when the doctor, who really was a turning point for me, he sat down and he said, the first thing you need to know is you're addicted, but it's not your fault. I'm not saying you did anything wrong. The second thing he said was, I believe you're still in pain. So it was that acknowledgement of why I was doing it. And then the third thing he said was, this was odd because my issues were all pancreatic. So this was a pancreatic specialist. And he said, what does a full life look like for you? And how can I be a partner in helping you achieve that? And that was something that I needed in my life. And I realized that we need to create those kinds of communities of grace and understanding, access to treatment, so that everybody has the kind of experience that I had.
My guest, Tim King, was an addict. And we're talking about opioid addiction that you hear about on the news, all the talk shows, all the news magazines. His condition, that is the condition that originally created a need to be free from the pain, and the need was the prescription opioid medicine that he refers to this way in his book. The only moment that I remembered I was still a person, that pain was an experience I was having and not my entire existence, was the moment every 15 minutes when I pressed a small button. That button sent a pump whirring and boosted the slow trickle of that blessed blessed analgesic. The pain medicine I'd been taking was deadening the nerve endings in my digestive tract and hindering my ability to process food. In other words, the pain medicine was now causing the pain. And the more I took to relieve the pain, the more pain I felt. And that's when my doctor told me I had a new and potentially fatal complication. He said, quote, "Tim, you need to know you are addicted to your pain medicine." But Tim, did he tell you how to kick it?
So I didn't realize at the time, but that question that he asked me is, what does a full life look like for you, was actually the beginning of my treatment. And one of the things that I didn't understand about addiction before is that addiction, overcoming addiction, is not so much about saying no to a particular substance or behavior, but saying yes to something that's greater. And he then referred me to another specialist. And so I started going through other therapy and getting help and assistance in other ways. And being able to identify, especially cognitive behavioral therapy was very helpful, and being able to identify different distortions in my own head and in my own mind about my need and dependence on that substance. But really where it all began was reorienting my focus, not to saying no to the substance, but saying yes to something greater. And one program that I highlight in my book is the LEAP program out of Seattle. And they started working with people who had much longer term addictions than I did, harder to work with populations, as addiction, like a lot of other medical issues, worsens as it goes on. So for me, I was lucky that we were working with an early stage addiction as opposed to something that had gone on for years or decades. So they started working with really down and out populations, all people who had been in and out of the prison system. And they asked the question of, we keep locking people up, and it seems like within hours of them getting free, they're going back and they're using the substance. What if we diverted a certain population and started instead with the question of, what do you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? Do you need housing? Do you want to go back to school? Can we help you find a job? And instead of requiring abstinence before they participated in the program, the hope was that abstinence could come because people started having things in their life that were worth abstaining for. And this program has now been incredibly successful, with a drop in recidivism for people who are treated of almost 50%. And I think that is one of the exciting opportunities that we can see. And the other thing that wasn't a part of my story, but has been incredibly important and has been shown time and time again to reduce overdose deaths by those who have access to it by almost 50%, is medically assisted treatment. And people might have heard of these kinds of treatments. Methadone has been the one that people have heard the most about, but there's also now buprenorphine and other treatments. This is something that actually allows you, while you're going through other kinds of talk therapy, as you're beginning to understand yourself and your own behavior better, these medicines are able to, in some ways they can mimic opioids, and in other ways they block opioids. And a lot of the times there's been opposition to this, and the most common objection is the idea that this is a crutch. And I say, well, if it's a crutch and you had a broken foot, of course you'd use one. And it is something that some people will be on for maybe a few months, other people will be on for years. But it's a highly effective treatment that I hope, and as we are able to overcome misunderstandings about what it is, more people will have access to.
How did your faith help, if at all?
So my faith both was a struggle for me, and there were some ways that It for a while, I think, made things harder. But as things progressed, it also made those changes, I think, go deeper. So the reason why I say it was harder for a little while is because, coming from the religious background that I did, I had a lot of good people who were praying for me while I was in the hospital. And at the same time, I had another family friend who was about my age who was in the hospital at the same time. And when I got out and I started getting better, my friend Peter actually went into hospice care and he passed away. And so at first, when I had people come to me and say, "Isn't God good? You're alive. You made it through." I reacted against that so strongly because I knew that Peter had passed away, and I did not think that my parents had prayed harder or that I was somehow more deserving than others because I was alive and Peter wasn't. And so I had a deep struggle with that, and that was at the heart of my own anxiety about getting better, was what that meant for me to come so close to dying and to come out alive and for another person not to make it. And at the same time, I remember, tell this story towards the end of the book, coming out and for one of the first times getting to walk outside again after everything had happened to me medically, still weak, and it being right before Easter and looking out at the beauty of the world around me and waiting for some sort of message. And I expected to go to church the next day and have God provide me some sort of message that gave meaning to everything that happened to me. And I remember sitting there with anticipation and suddenly having this realization that I would not hear any special message for me that day that was tailored just to me or was just what I needed. I actually was there to hear a message that has given hope to generations, that has given hope to millions and billions of people over the course of human history, that death is not the final end, that there is a promise of resurrection, and that that resurrection is a hope that is not something that it's just a history in our past, but it is a living present reality that I can participate in. And that after the own ways that I had parts of my life that died away, I was faced with that challenge of what does it look like for me to practice resurrection in my own life? I can keep going down a path in which I numb this pain, in which I take this anxiety and I medicate it with opioids, or I can start to look at what's next, at what ways that I can experience resurrection in my own life. And started looking at these different studies and immediately saw this one that just resonated with me so deeply, where they had taken all these brain scans of people who had struggled with a cocaine addiction. And they took them before while they were in the midst of the addiction, and then while they were in recovery. And addiction, one of the nefarious things about it is that it actually can reduce the size and the intricacy of the parts of our brain that help us with long-term planning and judgment making. So the very thing that we need the most to help us overcome is being damaged by the addiction itself. And so the researchers wanted to know, is this permanent, or is it possible for people to go back to where they were before? And so they follow up with folks and they keep checking in month after month, and around 6 months, it's getting close to where it was before, and around a year, the brain has healed itself. And then 18 months later, the surprise that they weren't expecting is that those who were in recovery, those parts of the brain were actually back and stronger than they ever were before. And I realized that's part of the promise that I want to live into my own life, this promise of resurrection, that it's not just that things can be restored to where they were before, but there is a new life, something even greater that can come about if we choose to participate in it.
You have been an observer, you've been a participant. So in either role or both, give me your thoughts on America's war on drugs.
The war on drugs has not been a war on drugs. It's been a war on people. It's been a war on addiction. And I think that especially when it comes to this area, we so often don't have a criminal justice system. We have a criminal punishment system. And this is where one thinker that I was really helped me put this all into place was René Girard, where he looked at scapegoat theory and this universal drive to find someone or something to blame and then to cast out. And that was the old practice of putting all of the sins of the people onto the head of a goat and then sending it out into the wilderness. Well, what I think happened in the United States is, you know, the overdose crisis started back in 1979. And the first big example of that was the rise of crack cocaine. And we looked at the rise of crack cocaine, and in communities across the country, there was a fear around that. We saw it ripping into communities. And instead of asking what's happened in those communities that has made so many people so vulnerable to addiction, we blamed people themselves, and mostly Black men and their families. And we cast out the scapegoat. We found the scapegoat. We said, this is the problem. These are the people who are susceptible to addiction. And so we locked up people at record rates. Well, most people put the end of the crack epidemic at around 1996, the very year that OxyContin was introduced. And it wasn't prescribed in most Black or brown neighborhoods or inner city neighborhoods. It was prescribed predominantly to white people in suburban and rural areas. And I think that there was this cultural, whether it was explicit or not, cultural understanding that white people were less, somehow less susceptible to addiction. And so what we ended up seeing was the fallacy of that scapegoat theory playing out. And that was when instead we thought we had solved the problem, but we didn't, and we actually made it worse. So back in the 90s when that was happening, we were at under 10,000 overdose deaths per year, and today we're at over 70,000. And so this war on people is a fundamental misunderstanding of what addiction is. And the way we've locked people up has made so many people believe that they are somehow not susceptible to the same kind of addiction that led to that person's incarceration.
How responsible is the pharmaceutical industry?
I think, and I have one chapter in my book called Sin, and it's not about the action of those struggling with addiction. It's about the actions of Purdue Pharma, one of the companies that's behind this. And at the same time that we see Purdue Pharma and we see these pharmaceutical companies, I think we need to broaden out that lens. Because once again, they're responding to a demand. And if there wasn't that demand, I don't think they would have the kind of power and the kind of wealth that they have. And one of the things with addiction is it's a self-harming behavior. So the idea that we take people who are engaged in a self-harming behavior and we think that harming them even more is going to somehow make it better is insanity. And that's where study after study has shown that incarceration doesn't make things better, it makes things worse. In fact, one study of over 1,200 IV drug users in Baltimore, they were looking for a whole host of factors that they thought would help people out of addiction. And they were looking at different programs and things like that. And they were a little disappointed at the end because the one thing they could find that was a consistent predictor of someone continuing to use is if that person had ever gone to jail for drugs. And when I started looking around at, you know, is there anybody who has done this better, right? Is there anyone who has figured out a way to deal with this? If punishment doesn't make sense, and right, me coming from a Christian tradition, one of the fundamental things I believe is that what's most transformative is not being punished, but receiving grace. Is there anyone else who's done this? And you look and you find Portugal. Portugal decided about 15 years ago to decriminalize all minor drug possession. So it's not completely legalized, but it's decriminalized, where if you're caught with a minor amount of drugs, you get fined and you can be put before a panel. But that panel doesn't send you to jail, doesn't call you a monster, doesn't tell you that you're what's wrong with society. They say, what do you need? A job. Do you need a place to live? They've even started giving out small business loans. And today, I was looking at the results. Today, Portugal has one of the lowest overdose rates in the EU. It's wow. gone up a little bit in the past few years, but it's around 6 per million. Mm. And I was just scratching my head, and I was like, all right, you know, what's the United States? And I had thought that the United States was around 19.6. And then I realized my error. Portugal's at 6 per million. The United States is at 19.6 per 100,000. So you need to move that decimal over. The United States, and this was, we're even higher now, we're over 210 now, overdoses per million people. So one of the things is, we can't just transfer what Portugal has done directly into the United States and expect it to work. We need to figure out something that's unique to our own country. But one thing that is clear is punishment as a primary response to addiction actually makes things worse. And if we want to make a difference, we need to stop this war on drugs, which is really a war on people, which is often an excuse to go after people who are already more marginalized, whether that's a poor white person in West Virginia, or that's a poor black person or an immigrant coming from Mexico or Central America. We need to stop that war. We need to invert our thinking and say, how do we spend more money on addressing the demand side? So helping people, getting them treatment, getting them things that make their, give their lives meaning, and flip that ratio so that we aren't thinking just about trying to stop supply anymore. This, the drug crisis, the overdose crisis, is fundamentally, I believe, an issue of demand, not just supply.
There's a variety of opioids when we're talking about any kind of opiate substance. Opium itself, that we always associate as an Asian drug from decades and decades and decades of use. Morphine. But the one that absolutely stuns me statistically is the one that you've been referring to, not only on this program, but also through the book, fentanyl, where you're talking about a drug that is so potent, so powerful, that a few grains of fentanyl can kill a family, that any kind of any kind of a container, a reasonably sized container of fentanyl, talking about putting a dent in the population of that area around where the fentanyl was found. I'm going to ask you a question I've never gotten a chance to ask anybody, and I know you can answer it. What does fentanyl feel like when it enters your body?
I wasn't expecting that question, but it's an interesting one. So fentanyl is, you know, a synthetic opioid. So it is very similar in effect to something like opium, which is, you know, it's coming from the naturally occurring plant, but it's increased in the potency. So it's narrowed in that chemical structure to just produce that kind of analgesic, that pain treatment effect. And so one of the things that, so I'll need to go back a little bit on the history of drug development. So you have opium, naturally occurring opium coming from the flower. Often, as you said, one of the first drug laws we had was specifically about opium smoking, targeted just Chinese users. So the railroads were pretty much finished, had lots of Chinese immigrants. There was a lot of resentment. And so opium was legal in alcohol form and pill form, but it was made illegal in smoking to target that group. Well, as different people saw that opium could be addictive, what did we create? Well, created morphine. Morphine was initially marketed as a cure for an opium habit. So we ended up with an even more potent substance being marketed. It also was thought that intravenous injection for a while might skirt addiction, because at the time we didn't understand a lot about addiction, and it was assumed that addiction was kind of like an appetite. So that if you didn't eat, if you didn't orally ingest the substance, they thought you might not be able to get addicted to it. So then it was intravenous injection, which just made it worse. And finally, some scientists came up with it, and they thought they had purified the substance enough so that it would no longer have any addictive properties, that there must be just something, some tainted aspect of opium that could cause addiction. And that was when they created a substance that was called in German Horoisch. And it turns out that English translation was heroin. So we now had an even more potent drug that was intended to treat opium addiction, to treat it and to get it, make it better. So the story of fentanyl was they made it so potent so that you could actually use it through a transdermal patch. So how I was taking fentanyl was actually just putting a patch on my arm. And because it was slowly being absorbed through my skin, it didn't create the normal high and low that taking it in an oral form, or especially in an intravenous form, would normally create. And so you don't actually notice it as much. So for me, I've never injected fentanyl, and so I don't know that experience. But with the patch, essentially that experience for me was a sort of peaceful deadening. So it was not an unpleasant experience.
But it wasn't a euphoria then.
No, and that normally would come through actually the less powerful but more quickly ingested oral form.
Mm.
So for those who try it intravenously, I quote one woman who she says, I think it's something like kissing Jesus, where it is this experience of almost an otherworldly transcendence. And I quote another author who, this was, you know, from hundreds of years ago, who talks about it almost mimicking a spiritual experience in a way, that you do feel as if you are beyond just your physical body and have entered into some sort of spiritual realm. And now, of course, the dark side of it is with a drug, there's the initial response, and then there's also the secondary response, and that is when your brain has gotten used to it, it adapts, and it swings in the other direction. So with anything that produces a temporary euphoria, there's also the dysphoria. And so that's one of the hard things about coming down, is that life becomes more bleak. And there's the temporary feeling of a lack of purpose, and that things won't get better.
Are there any moments
kind of hope?
Are there any moments, Tim, when you still want to do it?
Yes. And that was actually a challenge in writing the book, to go back and to relive some of those experiences. It still holds a draw. And that's one thing that I think is sometimes dangerous of how we talk about drugs, is as if there's, I remember being a kid and hearing, you know, you just say no, and you got to be crazy to want to do those kinds of drugs. And it fails to realize, like, it fails to acknowledge the temporary positive feelings that you can have with it. And so, and even writing the book, I had those moments of going back and feeling that craving for that experience. And it's very deeply wired into my brain now. One of the other things that I note is that I could have salt water injected into my veins that I know is completely inert. And this happened because I had to eat through a tube, like through an IV for a long time. I would push in salt water that I knew had no effect, and I would still feel a sense of euphoria from it. Because it's not just about what I consciously know. Mm. It's about what's been written into my brain well beneath conscious thought. And that's where we need, when we understand addiction, it's not just the conscious struggle. It is these deeper patterns that have been imprinted on our brain.
Tim McMahon King, author of Addiction Nation, and you've been listening to Tim talk about his personal experiences. Right now, somewhere in our listening audience, there is no doubt. There's no doubt on my part or yours that there are a number of people who really understand what you're talking about, because they're going through it right now. If opioids are prescribed for one of our listeners because of a condition, if opioids are prescribed by the family doctor for one of our listeners, what should that person say to the doctor?
I would have a couple levels of conversation. One is, if you don't feel comfortable, you can ask, do you feel this is medically necessary, and do you have anything else that you could recommend that I take in its place? If they encourage you to take the opioids, you can ask for a limited prescription that you feel is appropriate and that they feel is appropriate. That is a conversation you can have back and forth. And the third thing is, for those who like do take opioids for a short period of time, different studies who have looked at it still only put the amount of adults who will get addicted anywhere between 10 and 18% who will have some sort of struggle there. So the majority of people will not actually immediately have a struggle. But what I'd say to that is always, you can take opioids and you can take them safely, especially for a limited period of time. And the best thing to do is to be aware that it is possible to become addicted. And once you have that knowledge that that is a possibility, you will have a better sense in yourself of when you move from a place of saying, this is something that's necessary for me to help overcome a knee surgery, a back surgery, oral surgery, into a place of, I'm feeling like I need this just to get through the day to make myself feel better. And that is a tipping point that can be identified early on. But I actually don't want your listeners to be afraid of taking opioids. That's something that can happen in a responsible way. They aren't evil in and of themselves. But it's important to be aware of the ways that they can go wrong. And there might even be some of your listeners who are chronic pain patients. And this is an even harder area. What I'd say there is, there are chronic pain patients who have found that opioids have been the only thing that helped them. Now, I think that's a last resort. I think it's important to look at holistic treatment and to find different ways, whether that's physical therapy or any kinds of prayer, meditation. There's a lot of different things that can be helpful that you might not have been able to try with your doctor. But there are going to be a certain population of chronic pain patients that might be the best option for them. And I want to make sure that they don't feel like they're being demonized either, because there has been an increase in suicide of chronic pain patients who have unfairly been cut off from a responsible prescription from their doctor.
Was there a single... Go ahead, Tim.
Well, it's hard to know the difference, but that's important to have the conversation with your doctor and to make sure that you know that it doesn't need to be one-sided.
Was there a single entity, person, experience that was singularly most important in freeing you from your addiction?
There was two different moments that I will reference. One is where I've already told you about, was that moment with my doctor. Now, that was not an immediate 180. I didn't go out the next day and stop taking pain medicine. But that initial experience with him in an empathetic setting reoriented me in a way that I could take the next steps that were necessary with additional counseling, with additional work, with additional support. And so that moment of empathy and love and understanding, I can't stress how important that was. And then the second moment that's tied into that was one of the people I interviewed for my book was one of the world's leading addiction researchers, William R. Miller, because I had never understood why I kept going back to that one conversation, why I kept going back to that one moment with my doctor, who wasn't someone I knew that well. And he just smiled and laughed. And he said, that was one of the big mysteries in my research. He goes, when I first started studying addiction, I wanted to prove that you needed a lot of therapy in order to get better. And he goes, so I set up some experiments where one group got 5 hours of therapy and another group got 15 hours of therapy. And then we studied the difference and there wasn't a big difference. So then we did another round and we made the differences even bigger. And still there wasn't a substantial difference, or at least the amount that you would predict. And he goes, and then I started looking at the literature and we started controlling for everything we could. And we found that there was a whole bunch of studies that all seemed to be aberrations, but all pointed to one thing, that very small interactions with someone struggling with an addiction at the right time that were loving and empathetic had outsized differences in people overcoming their addiction. And he says, so one thing that people need to understand is whether or not you are a doctor, whether or not you're a therapist, whether or not you're a counselor, maybe you're a pastor, lay leader, if you're in a small group or a meditation group, any of these things, small interactions of love and empathy can have outsized effects that help reorient someone towards that path, that it might not happen that day, it might not even happen that year, but it can set them on the trajectory to overcoming.
The profundity of that, Tim. Yes, please go ahead, but be brief because we've only got 30 seconds left.
That is where that sort of love, Teilhard de Chardin said that someday we will come back and discover the power of love. And for the second time in human history, we will have discovered fire.
I started to say that the profundity of what you've been saying, and particularly these last few minutes, I have been extremely fortunate just simply because of the fact that I haven't been introduced to those areas of temptation that we've been talking about this hour, but I easily could have been. I appreciate you more than you know, even though I am listening to you as an observer, but as an interested observer, because I got a chance to meet you on the God Show, as have all of these people who perhaps may have learned a lesson far closer to your life than I can understand. Timothy McMahon King. The book is Addiction Nation, and this is the God Show. God Show. God Show. God Show. God Show.